We are live now on the Conversations That Matter podcast. I'm your host, John Harris, and here to introduce you to some breaking news. I'm really excited that this happened. I thought it would. I didn't realize it was going to be in the margins that are as high as they are, but the SBC presidency race has been won by Willie Rice with almost 60% of the vote, 57.56% to Josh Powell, who had 42.16%. This is according to Center for Baptist Leadership with a screenshot from the convention hall. And of course, I have texts from people there and they're telling me what happened and giving me the play-by-play. This is not something that happened within the last day or two, though. This is something that's been going on for months. There's been momentum building. There's been a coalition forming. And I want to take you through at least some of the things that I think really contributed to this and why this happened. This is a huge success. This is something that many of us did not think was possible a few years ago. Why was it possible this year? Let's get into that a little bit. Excited to get comments from those, especially those who are at the largest Protestant denomination in the country's annual meeting. And tomorrow I will be there. So if you are there and you're listening to me right now, I'm going to get on a flight tomorrow morning really early, and I should be there hopefully by about 1 p.m. So I'm going to just get there for the afternoon sessions and meetings as the whole thing's coming to a close, I suppose. But I didn't really have any other time I could do it. And I wanted to go this year because I have never thought we would win, as in conservatives that are polling for the Southern Baptist Convention to be rescued in fidelity from the leftward drift that it was in until this year. I really just thought this year was going to be the year. And I started making videos about it. I think last October was when I started saying there's an opportunity here, guys. And you've never heard me say that. Like, not like I have this time. I've always been very skeptical until this year. And so we're going to get into why I thought that and why I think, well, the evidence shows a lot of other people thought that as well. And Stormy Squad is correct. William Wolf and the Center for Baptist Leadership are also big winners today. They put in a lot of work. And believe me, I don't think William talks about all the hurdles and challenges. He was really optimistic, even as I had a very bad internet connection last week and he tried to do a podcast with me and it wasn't working. He kept a good attitude. And I know that it's been rough. It's been hard. It's been an uphill battle in many ways for him and the Center for Baptist Leadership. And they pulled it off. They kept going. And there's just a lot of stories that hopefully in the next few weeks will come out about people who pushed really hard and just came together at the last minute. And one of the things that I think was really cool was that the Willie Rice made a speech at the pastor's conference yesterday. And I want to play for you a little clip. And let me know, please, if you can't hear this, because for some reason on my end, I'm not able to hear this. I don't know why, but I figured hopefully you'll be able to hear it. So let me know as this is playing, if you can hear it or cannot hear it, just leave a comment, whether you're on YouTube or Facebook or X, just put a comment there and say, I can hear it if you can, just so I know you're listening.
Lights. I want a Southern Baptist convention that is successful, but I want one that is faithful even more. Faithfulness today will bring fruitfulness tomorrow, but success today, if rooted in compromise, will foreshadow a greater defeat to come. Yes, of course, we will share our reports this week. There's nothing wrong with that. We can and should rejoice at every measure of advance. But there is another report that matters more than anything that is printed in a book this week. It is what God sees when He looks at our hearts and He measures whether or not we are committed to obey Him regardless of the cost.
Well, there you have it. There's Willie Rice at the pastor's conference. I listened to the whole sermon. I haven't heard something like that from the Southern Baptist Convention in a long time. It reminded me of messages from history by people like Adrian Rogers. I just had never heard anything quite like that. He did so in a very diplomatic, general way, but he basically rebuked the Southern Baptist Convention for following pragmatism and the opinions of men and the experts instead of what the scripture clearly teaches. At one point, he actually held up the Bible and said, look, we have a book. We can go to that and get our answers for how to do ministry. We don't have to go to all the experts and what they figured out. We know what we believe. So it was such a great speech by Willie Rice, and really emphasized to me, this man loves the Lord. This man has a passion. He doesn't care about the success and the typical things you hear every year from that stage. He just stood out to me as someone who was caring about the main thing. He kept the main thing the main thing. So that's really encouraging. And I hope that this is, I mean, I know that this is going to be good. I just think Willie Rice is going to have a little bit of an uphill battle. It's like, not to create too strong of a parallel, but in a political way, we all are familiar with Trump going in to drain the swamp, and the swamp is so big and the swamp is so ominous and secretive and powerful. And Willie Rice is in a similar position in the Southern Baptist Convention. He's up against a lot of things, a lot of forces. And he was interviewed, I think this was also yesterday, for an event. And I want you to hear the contrast between him and the candidate he was up against, and what they said differentiated them as far as how they would handle the Southern Baptist Convention and their position as president.
Individually assess is the biggest difference between the two of you. Mm. Obviously, people are going to have to make a choice tomorrow. And you, man, you're both godly. You both love your families. You both love the Lord. Where would you say there is the biggest difference between
the
two?
Yeah, you know, and the scary thing is, because I don't want to misspeak or mischaracterize his position at all. So all I can do is speak from my heart. And, I've listened to what he says. And I think we're very similar on a lot of things. I really thought, again, I didn't know Josh well, you kind of almost hope when you're doing something like this, not that there's any acrimony, I didn't want that, but that there'd be a huge difference, like a huge difference, because then it's easier to talk about the differences. I think I would challenge the system a little more. I mean, I love the system. I'm not trying to burn it down. I'm not an iconoclast. Listen, I've been in the system. I've been on the committees. I get them confused of which committee I was on and chair, nominations, committee on committees, pastors conference president, Florida Baptist Convention president. I mean, I've been in the system. So if I sit here tonight and go, I don't like the system, everybody's going to laugh because that's not true. They know I've been in the system. I love it. I'm not trying to burn it down. But I do think a president has to challenge the system. I don't think the president just goes, and again, I'm not saying Josh would do this. I don't think it's the job of the president to just, be the PR agent, cut ribbons, and give good speeches. I do think you have to challenge the system. I do think you have to lead the entity leaders. I think not that you do their job, but you make suggestions, you probe, you challenge, you set vision. And I don't know. He might not agree with that, that I may not be characterizing it fairly. But I think I would maybe challenge the system a little more than just be content to be in the system. And again, I don't even like saying it because that may be a mischaracterization. But I think people perceive me as he's going to challenge the system a little more.
Yeah. Josh.
Yeah, again, this is a tough question because it's just, again, if there's six of us up here, it's a different right. way to answer it. And I don't want to disparage anyway. I do want to say, from my perspective, I have great optimism for who we are as Southern Baptists. I have great optimism for what we have accomplished and what we can accomplish together. And I want to press into that optimism and move forward. And maybe if that means challenging less and championing more, it may be a slight difference in what we do. And that would probably be where I would land, be a champion for who we are as Southern Baptists and move forward with the Great Commission.
Yeah.
Well, there you have it. Willie Rice, unapologetic about the fact that he's going to challenge the establishment, that he sees the Southern Baptist Convention, he sees problems, he wants to do something about it. One of those is the women pastor issue. But it's not just that, it's corruption, it's waste, it's trying to do things that are cutting corners and things that are maybe what the expert class thinks, but not what the Word of God teaches. And he sees all this and he wants to go do something about it. And despite the fact that he wants to do this and announces it publicly, he still wins, which I find to be amazing. If you remember, the last Southern Baptist Convention where the conservatives kind of got close was in 2021, and Mike Stone was, I forget the final vote, but he was fairly close. It was, I think, within like, it was like 100 votes or something. It was very close. And he ended up losing, but there was also a hit on him at the beginning of the convention. And there wasn't that kind of a hit on Willie Rice. People were wondering if that could happen. And I told you this back in October. I said, it's going to be hard for him to do it. And the reason it's going to be hard for them to do it is because of who Willie Rice is. Willie Rice is someone who's been around the SBC. I know Mike Stone has too, not to compare them too much. I mean, they could have tried it on Willie Rice. I just think that Willie Rice, he got close to a lot of the people who were running the show. And he was on their team, which is a bit different. He was someone who was, and he repented of this, was believing what they said. He even in 2021, I was criticizing him in some ways because he was saying things that weren't true about January 6th and really just following the SBC bigwig mainstream narrative. And he knew all those guys and he still knows them. Because he's so close, I told you, he doesn't have to tell me. I just know he knows where some skeletons are buried. He knows these guys well enough. And if they try to do something to him, there could be collateral damage. Now, is this speculation on my part? Sure, but it's just experience with being around these circles and politics for a while. It's just, you know, when someone's that close, they tend to be in each other's chat groups and text threads, and they've been at each other's churches and homes, and they've shared things with each other. And I just know if Willie Rice is a man of integrity, the man that I believe him to be, and he's been observing some of those things, and he realizes that this went too far, things are off kilter, they're wrong. He knows things that you and I don't know. And that's a dangerous man. I think Trump is a similar situation in the sense that he did a lateral move. He was someone that the big wigs in politics and entertainment liked, and he was funny. He was an entertainer. And then he turned. Now, they did try to do things to him. Obviously, they did try to pull all kinds of stops. I think it was difficult, though, for them, more so because he had been so close to some of these people. And I just know that dynamic does exist. So they didn't try anything like they did with Mike Stone with really Rice. He was on home turf. He was in Florida. This is where he's a pastor already. He's well known. Circumstances just worked out really well for this. And there was a very high attendance for the Southern Baptist Convention, which I want to show you. This is pretty amazing. Christian Post, growing spirit of optimism, 20,000 to attend SBC's annual meeting in Orlando. I don't know what the final count will be, but it says this will be our largest annual meeting since Nashville in 2021, and we can't wait to see SBC families. So if that's true, and that was the closest conservatives got was 2021 to any kind of victory, I'd say it's a good sign that a lot of outsiders showed up. People who normally don't go to the convention decided to come. Compare that to other years. If you go back to last year, it was not even 11,000 messengers and total attendees around 18,000. So you had guests and exhibitors, but in Indianapolis, even less. You had almost 17,000 total attendees, around 19,000 in 2023, around 10,000 in 2022. So there was an upsurge of people wanting to go. And it's partially because of, I'm not taking full credit at all for this, but it's partially because of outlets like this. It's because of the work of Center for Baptist Leadership. It's because people like Megan Basham put the word out there and said, look, this is the year, guys, you got to go. The ERLC is not causing the problems that they were causing. The resolutions aren't like they were in years past. There's some problems, but not as bad as they were in years past. You've even got people who are more conservative that are on the credentials or the resolutions committee. You've got a president who has been fairly moderate. There's just a lot of things that really helped Willie Rice, I think, in the long run win this. But of course, one of the things that I said, I'm going to do this, and I made the commitment last fall, is we're going to do a documentary on the woman pastor compromise issue in the Southern Baptist Convention. And sure enough, we did it. It came out last week through the Church Reform Initiative. This was something that I put a lot of work into, and there were others too. My editor, Andrew Joyce, put a lot of work into the edits and everything. We had a guy named Andrew who helped out. I guess I'm surrounded by Andrews, who also helped out with doing some of the research to just get some clips from SBC churches with women pastors. We had 12 churches that we featured, and then we interviewed people on this topic. And so you can go check that out if you haven't, but we dropped that purposely on Friday of last week. And it's, I don't even know what the view count is up to. It's probably up to about 10,000 now or so. We really wanted to target Southern Baptist Convention messengers so that they knew this was a problem. And the solution we presented was, sure, look at this unity amendment that Al Mohler's got, but bigger than that was Willie Rice needs to be elected because personnel's policy. That's the point we made. And that point got through loud and clear. If you support my work, this podcast, that's the kind of thing that we felt, the supporters and myself and the Church Reform Initiative, we felt this was a good thing. This was something that we could do to make a positive impact. And I feel very good about it. Sure enough, I think we did by God's grace. It's really something that he was able to bring together as well. And through circumstance that we even had a NAM whistleblower come out. We didn't expect that, to talk about what NAM was saying behind the scenes, what Kevin Ezell knew and really failed in. And sure enough, there were some bigwigs in the SBC who didn't like the fact that we put this out there. So I'll just show you a few of those examples. Bruce Frank showed up in a documentary that I did on FBC Naples because he recommended Marcus Hayes, if anyone remembers back that far. But Bruce Frank comes out about, this is not directly tied to the documentary. This is about the woman pastor crisis, though. This, and he says, basically, what do you mean there's a female pastor crisis? Because, I mean, this is the title of our documentary, right? So he says, look, is it any greater than the sexual abuse crisis? And Megan Basham is saying, there is a problem here. And she cites the documentary that she was in. And then Bruce Frank keeps going and he says, well, look, you know, I'll watch the documentary, but we need these hard facts. What do you mean? And they go back and forth. And I say, well, wait a minute, look at this. Under 1% of churches that had abuse, and this was abuse that was, you know, legally speaking, we knew there was abuse. Under 1% of Southern Baptist churches over a 30-year period had abuse situations. And that was supposed to be a crisis. We were supposed to change the entire Southern Baptist Convention for this. And you have 40% of messengers last year, who didn't think the SBC should uphold its own standards on female pastors. So that's the metric to go by. And I pointed this out. I said, the metric to go by isn't how many churches that have female pastors or senior pastors, which is usually what they want to do. We don't know exactly. There's been estimates that it's over 1,000. But the problem with this is the numbers change partially because these churches get better at covering it up. You have churches that had female pastors that are now calling them shepherds or something else, or they're on the preaching committee or something, and they're doing that. But this is the issue. There really is not a way to do this unless you have a lot of manpower. And so I highlighted 12 churches that are blatantly doing this, that are part of the Southern Baptist Convention. I don't know exactly how many there are. Mike Law, I think, had an estimate of like around 1,800. But regardless, that's not the thing to keep in mind. The thing to keep in mind is how many at the convention of the messengers voted to give the credentials committee the enhancement they need to deal with it. They did it on abuse. They did it on racism, quote unquote, but they don't want to do it on this until hopefully this year and next year. Hopefully we'll see some movement in this, but that's the issue. And then I followed up and said, look, no one is out there saying the Bible and Baptist doctrine allow abuse. They are saying it allows female pastors. And I said, right, Wade Burleson, because he's one of the people that's prominent in the Southern Baptist Convention who's supporting female pastors. That's the issue. There's no one in the SBC who's saying, you know, I support abuse. No one says that. But people do say I support female pastors. Look at Dwight McKissick. They're a prominent pastor in the Southern Baptist Convention. He supports it and he's out there with it. So it's a very different issue and it's a doctrinal issue that needs to be addressed. So yeah, you could say it's a crisis of doctrine and that's really the issue. Anyway, there were some others. I wanted to show you this. This was interesting to me. So James Merritt came out. James Merritt said, the old saying is true. When you try to defend yourself, your enemies won't believe it. Your friends don't need it. Just note the Pharisees falsely criticized Jesus as being liberal. When modern day Pharisees criticize me and my friends falsely, I consider the source. This is, the timing is unmistakable. This is about the documentary I put out. the reason that he's saying this is because in the documentary, there's a image of him from, I think it's 2022, with Greer and Ed Litton, and I think two other members or two other former presidents of the Southern Baptist Convention, saying, let's form a committee to really study this issue of friendly cooperation and women pastors, because we don't want to be too hasty and rush into something here. Well, that was a move that Tom Buck, he said in the documentary, look, this is, I think it was it Tom Buck, might have been Bob Pearl. Bob Pearl said, look, this is something that they're using as a stall tactic. It's a shell game. That's what this is. And James Merritt saying, this is me and my friends. We're being slandered again, right? And they say this kind of stuff. And then, of course, you know, he says, you know, I consider the source. I guess I'm the source. I'm the bad guy. I'm the source. Now, here's the thing that's interesting to me. I didn't respond to it, but Kevin Ezell of the North American Mission Board. Good word, brother. Dean and Sarah. Amen. Jimmy Scroggins. True, James. I'm your friend and I don't need it. Todd Unzicker. Amen, Doc. Now, I know all these names because I know these are guys from the past who have carried water for the liberals. I call them liberals in the Southern Baptist Convention on issues like the Me Too abuse stuff, on the CRT stuff. They're company men, in my opinion. That's who they've been, at least. That's the track record. And that's a good way. Like, you don't see this much anymore because the Southern Baptist bigwigs don't tweet as much as they did. Twitter's not a very conducive environment. Twitter's changed, and that's another topic. But every once in a while, when you see an opinion like this drop, it's worth noticing. It's worth saying, look, some of these guys, they haven't changed. And no one slandered James Merritt. People have just told the truth about James Merritt, and he wants to take it as slander. So I will say this. Look, if you're someone who thinks a practicing homosexual or someone who is not repentant of that and says they're homosexual preaches a good sermon, and you're willing to go out publicly as a pastor and say and recommend that and say, this is a good sermon from someone who's a practicing homosexual, is that conservative or liberal? You know, these are the things that cause people to say, James Merritt, you may be conservative if you look at the metrics and judge by the metrics of like the political landscape in a blue city or something, because you're pro-life. But if you look at the Southern Baptist Convention and you judge by the metrics of that convention and the general political disposition, you'd be more on the left. James Merritt's the one who, when he was the chair of, I believe it was the Credentials Committee, said, if we just drop this CRT obsession and started focusing on evangelism, we'd save the world. You got to stop talking about this CRT stuff. That's just who he is. That's who he's been. So I don't find it shocking that he didn't like the documentary. Well, in other news, I am going to be in the coming week. I got a lot of travel. Pray for me. I'll be in Orlando tomorrow and Thursday. But then on Friday and Saturday, I'm going to be at the Church Militant Conference, which is in Vancouver, Washington. The Church Militant Conference at mastersbiblechurch.com. You can go check it out and register there. I think it's like $60, something like that, if you're a pastor to come, but you don't need to be a pastor. You can be a layman or anyone. And I'm going to be speaking. In fact, I just wrote it this morning on political alliances and Christians and navigating the ecumenicism and the political maneuvering that's going on today. And by the way, there's a lot of it. There's a lot of areas of potential compromise we need to talk about. So I would love for you to come out. There's a lot of good things to talk about too. But let's see. I have a number of clips I want to play. I can't hear them, so I'm kind of reluctant to play them. But I'm trying to think if there's anything Southern Baptist. I will say tomorrow is big because tomorrow they're going to have an opportunity to vote again on this revised law amendment, this amendment to the Constitution of the Southern Baptist Convention to denote friendly cooperation as being only in accordance with the office and function of an elder being male. And so that's going to be tomorrow. I'm expecting that to pass, to be quite honest with you. And we'll see what happens. But momentum looks pretty good right now for that. Okay, other issues. Let's talk about this next. This is just something I needed to talk about on the podcast. Gallup poll says U.S. support for LGBT plus issues remains down from its peak. And so they took a poll, and in that poll, it shows that there's a slight dip going on here. From 2022 to 2026, you can see same-sex marriages should be valid among U.S. adults. High point, 71% 2023, and fallen to 65%. Now, you know, it could be just, you know, you have valleys in here. So maybe it's just a little valley. But look, this could be significant also. The moral acceptability has gone down too. Now, here's the question. You see Republicans, it's only at 35% that they say that this is morally acceptable. You see for other groups, for moderates, 64%. For Democrats, it's like it barely dipped. It really hasn't dipped. It's still remaining at 81%. So what do we make of all this? There's a couple things going on. I think that there's kind of an echo. There's the LGBT folks push really hard, and 2021 was insane. I think they push so hard that there's a lot of people who are sick of it being in their face. And time will tell whether this is a conviction or not. Is this something I'm just tired of this? Or is this something where, I think this is actually immoral because it's out of step with the way we're designed, with the way God created us. If it's that, there's a lot more hope. If it's just, I'm sick of this stuff being shoved in my face, I don't like the consequences of this. I thought they said they were going to leave us alone with marriage, and instead we got trans and kids and women and boys locker rooms and vice versa. I don't want women and men playing sports together. I don't want that forced on us, at least. It's hard to say at this point. I mean, this doesn't really give us that information, but I will say no matter what, it's good to see a dip. It obviously needs to be a lot more, and we don't know whether this is temporary or this trend will continue. The only thing in my mind that makes the trend continue is two things. If the LGBT lobby pushes really hard and keeps pushing, that will make people annoyed, and that could continue the trend. Or if people are sincere in believing that this is actually immoral because of some kind of religious awakening. Now, I've talked about that before. I remain unconvinced that we are in some kind of a Christian awakening. At the same time, I do think something is happening where people are interested in spirituality more. I've looked at all the data that I have available and have concluded, based off of everything, that it does appear that younger people are more interested in spirituality, but that has not translated yet into actual commitment that looks like it's a long-term Christian commitment. We're going to have to see an increase in clergy, an increase in church membership. We may have a slight increase in that, by the way, in church membership. We're going to need more information, though. So let's be cautiously optimistic about this and just see what happens. I think, you know, the Trump administration is in, so we don't have these things being pushed from the federal level, which is really great, or the national general level. And you have stuff like this. This is interesting. In the state of New York, there's a restroom bill, and I'll just read for you a portion of this, that would direct New York State to allow and facilitate the construction of multi-stall unisex restrooms. Now, why would they want to do that? Well, it says there's a need for this. And the need is based upon the fact that women don't feel safe in part. So this is kind of an admission without admitting it, that we need a third option here, because if we just have male and female and males keep going into female restrooms, that makes women feel unsafe. It's obvious what's happening here. So very liberal state, New York, but New York has to address with legislation the fact that their ideas haven't worked out so well. So I think that's very interesting. And TruthScript continuing to push, continuing to produce really helpful information. If you want to support TruthScript, you go to truthscript.com, scroll to the bottom. You can support us by contributing essays that you write. You can support by contributing financially. You can pray for us. But Is God Non-Binary is the article for Pride Month, to kick off Pride Month. And I would encourage you to go check that out. These are easy to share. These are kind of bite-sized articles that you can go over it in a discussion group, a Sunday school class, wherever you think, but it's meant for easy accessibility. And I have an article actually coming out, hopefully, I think this week, unless they schedule it for next week, from TruthScript as well, on the PCA and what's going on with Christian nationalism, and this study report that Zach Garris and Sean McGowan and Stephen Wolf put together. So you can look forward to that as well. In other news, just a few things I wanted to mention. Truth Nigeria does some great work on what's happening in Nigeria. And we shouldn't forget about what's happening around the world. I know the Middle East gets a lot of attention, but in Africa, we have a lot of brothers and sisters that are dying. The army frees 360 hostages, but mass kidnappings surge across Nigeria in one deadly week. In the early hours of Monday, June 1st, suspected terrorists invaded a community in Kababunu County in the Kogi state around 3:30 a.m. You see, this is what they do. They come in the middle of the night when you're sleeping and defenseless, and that's when they decide to start killing people sometimes. And they did. They injured five people. They killed two. They abducted no fewer than 28. Troops from the Nigerian Army's 12th Brigade mobilized, and they ended up rescuing the 23 abducted passengers. I'm glad that they actually did something about this. On Tuesday, Christian farmers were ambushed and killed in Apa County while working on their land. The assailants killed three farmers while women sustained serious injuries. I can't even imagine. Residents traced the occupation to coordinated attacks between April 2nd and April 3rd, 2026, when more than 200 heavily armed militants swept through multiple villages, killing residents and burning homes. Police confirmed at least 11 dead and the destruction of more than 50 houses. Community leaders say the toll exceeded 80. I mean, this is the same ideology. I mean, we hear about October 6th. We certainly hear a lot about the reaction to October 6th and the war currently between Hezbollah and in Jordan and Israel. And it is a war. It's a proxy war between Israel and Iran. It's still going on. We hear about these things, but in Nigeria, we have Christian brothers who are being murdered left and right. And they are under the same ideology as the terrorists in the Middle East. It's the same thing. And we're going to keep letting you know about it because I think it's important. And you can support what's going on. You can support your Christian response to it, at least by going to Equipping the Persecuted and checking them out. Speaking of the Middle East, I just want to say rather briefly, I want to point something out because I've been keeping an eye on what's been going on over there. And it's a mess like it always is. But there was an attack this morning on an Apache helicopter. No one died from Iran. And Trump canceled the last attack on Iran. He was going to attack them. And let's just say Israel's not, things are a little depressed over there. There's growing concern in Jerusalem that U.S. President Donald Trump might not give Israel the green light to respond to Iranian attacks. Now, listen to how this is framed. This is a Jerusalem with a limited or symbolic strike. Israel might find itself in a situation where it has to confront Iran alone. Prime Minister Netanyahu said Tuesday at a meeting of the Security Cabinet, "We may have to strike without America backing, despite all the costs involved. We do not want to reach that point, but we know we are capable of it." That might be a threat that he wanted to get out. I don't know, but Trump, there's been a bunch of things. Trump, there's been friction between Trump and Netanyahu, according to some reports. Whether that's the case, I mean, they smile for the cameras, and Netanyahu says, "No, we love Trump." But I think they kind of have to. You got to think about the position Israel's in. Allies are thin. They really want us to be supportive. And the problem has always been in the Middle East foreign policy. And this is since I've been a little kid, because I had a dad who paid attention to this stuff. And we talk about it around the table and so forth, just politics in general. And this came up. But the issue is this. The United States has foreign policy interests in the Middle East. We have several bases. Certainly the price of oil and our economic interests there are important to us. We want to maintain influence in the region because it's an important economic region. And it's also a region where there's a lot of competition between us and China and even Russia. And Iran has been one of our biggest problems in the area. Here's the thing. Israel and the United States have shared interests on seeing Iran as a threat, for example. However, Israel has obviously, because of their close proximity, a much bigger problem than the United States has. The United States is on the other side of the world. Our military bases aren't, but we are. And so Israel has a much bigger vested interest in taking Iran out because Iran is a clear and present threat with nuclear capabilities, if they ever get them, that may be deployed against Israel. And so Israel has a much bigger motivation for wanting to stop Iran. They're also surrounded by these proxies. So Hezbollah is shooting at Israel. we're interested primarily in ourselves, in Iran being an enemy. We're interested in mitigating that threat, and we've managed it for years. Israel's helped along those lines, surely, but we're not as interested in the proxy wars that Israel has with terrorists on their borders, because that's Israel and it's not us. Now, they're obviously connected to enemies of us, but Hezbollah, I think we would have found the sleeper. I'm not saying there aren't sleeper cells that Iran has, but I think we would have probably undergone more of that violence if they were a more clear and present threat in the last few months. And that hasn't seemed to manifest. So Israel is in a much more vulnerable position. Now, the interest of the United States right now is basically to get a deal. What's the deal? Iran can't have a nuclear weapon. That's the main part of all of this. That was what got us into this from the first place. That's what Trump's still negotiating, and Trump is working over the boardroom. That's what he's trying to do. And he's working with, I mean, these are people who are religious zealots. It's not exactly easy. They're hiding in caves. They can bring their missiles out of the caves. That's why we would destroy all their stuff. But then they have stuff hiding in these caves they can whip out. That's why it's harder with the Strait of Hormuz, because to control it is very expensive. The United States could do it, but at what cost? It would take probably a land invasion. But even if we wanted to just escort ships, we are fighting drones that are much cheaper than the military equipment we're using to shoot down their drones and their missiles. So it just, it's something that bankrupts us. That's been one of the problems from the beginning. So I'm not going to spend much more time on this, but I just wanted to make the point that the interests of the United States and Israel aren't necessarily always in lockstep. And this has been since I was a kid. Every president that I've lived under has always been yanking Israel's chain, has always said, don't do this. You can't do this. You got to stop doing this. And Israel has eventually acquiesced. That's why you see Netanyahu try to rush when he knows there's a peace deal coming. All right, we got to try to take out as much as we can when it comes to Hezbollah, because if we don't get it in now, if we don't bomb Iran now, they're going to have a treaty and then we can't because of the U.S. So, and this caused Trump to have a problem with Netanyahu. I don't hear any of the people online who focus so much on our relationship with Israel talking about this. I don't see anything. Now, I'm not saying no one has, but of all the people in my mind that I can think of, and I have names in my head that love to talk about how Trump's just a shill for Israel and Israel's controlling Trump and Israel and all of that, they're not talking about this. They get awfully quiet when these scenarios come up, and they come up in most of the conflicts that we're involved with Israel. It comes up at some point. Israel wants to keep going or do more, and the United States is trying, we're settling down, we're trying to get a peace deal because we've achieved or are close to achieving the objectives that matter to us. And for us, it's basically keep Iran from getting a nuclear missile, and it's a management thing. We are kicking the can down the road. We've always done that. We've always just make sure that they don't get that, but otherwise, if they're not hurting anyone, if they're not hurting us, we don't feel it as much. So that's what's happening right now in the world. And I just figured you're probably not going to hear it from some of these other podcasts that talk about Israel a lot. So I might as well at least tell you that's what's going on. Okay. Some other outstanding things. I was going to talk a little bit about the Los Angeles County election, or the mayoral election. There's some really fishy stuff, it looks like. And that doesn't surprise me in California politics, but I'm not going to spend much more time because I have a limited amount of time here. I don't know what the solution is. That's the main reason I'm not going to spend more time. I don't know really what to say about California. I love it. It's my home state. It's where I was born. I wrote a song about it in my upcoming album that's going to come out in July. And I love California. If it was conservative, if it was halfway sane, I'd probably be out there in a hot second. I absolutely love the terrain. I love the people. I love the landscape. I wish I was there in so many ways. Just because I love that state. It is my home in a way. It just culturally, I feel an affinity, but I have no political solution for California. I don't know what to do there. As a Republican, what do you even do? You got to keep trying, but it seems like it's a rigged system. And when you have the election commissioners and the committees all run by Democrats, then how do you even navigate that? I mean, it would have to be broken. It would have to be force coming from the outside, or some kind of a real landslide from the inside, and a like sort of a within the Democratic Party, there'd have to be some disruption. And maybe that is the way ahead, to be quite honest. Maybe it is causing chaos within the Democrat Party and just sort of realizing this is a one-party state. And so if we're going to get anything done, you have to be in the Democrat Party to do it. I don't even know how you pull that off, though. So I don't really have much to add, unfortunately. I wish I had more. Steven Spielberg, I'm not going to play the clip, but he basically says, look, I'm making this movie Disclosure Day. And is God our God only on this planet, or is God a God of every system where there's civilization? That would mess up a lot of people. So he's going to show you, man, there might be aliens out there. People are going to have to rethink their religions. No, they won't. No, they won't. People are going to be able to look at things squarely and say, there's demons. There's demons out there. There's spiritual entities that God created that are outside the physical world that can manifest themselves physically. And that can certainly account for this. The laws of physics don't allow someone coming from the distances they need to come to get here with any kind of material spaceship. That's why people today who talk about UFOs and stuff say they're interdimensional beings or interdimensional spacecraft, because that's the only way they can conceive of it. But once you start talking about interdimensional, then I think we're pretty close to, are we not saying spiritual? So again, I think...
Hey, it's John. I've been using Marsmen for a few months now, and I honestly can say that I feel pretty good. I'm not dragging through workouts. I'm not wiped out after chasing my little girl or handling stuff around the house. As a husband and a father, I take it seriously. I want to stay strong, energized, and capable for my family. Marsmen makes that easier. It's packed with 8 powerful, clinically dosed ingredients like Onkat Ali, Chilajit, Fenugreek, Taurine, Zinc, Boron, Vitamin D, and Vitamin K that work together to support natural testosterone, energy, strength, and recovery. Most guys don't realize it until it hits them, but during the middle age years, you start to lose some of your testosterone. Right now, listeners get a great deal, 50% off for life, free shipping, free gifts, plus their 90-day higher T guarantee. Go to mengotomars.com and grab yours today, and don't forget to let them know that Conversations That Matter sent you. God bless.
Steven Spielberg's not going to reveal anything that's going to be like having to rework our Christianity. If anything, I think whatever's revealed seems to keep affirming that the Christian understanding makes the most sense. I think it's going to be more problems for people who have a hyper scientific worldview or outlook, religious view that says that that spacecraft came from these long distances. That's just not really, you can't really jive that with those distances, the friction alone and the time and everything, it doesn't allow for it. Now, the only thing you really have here as far as evolution is concerned and scientism is the idea that these aliens must exist because they evolved. It's the old cosmos thing. It's the idea that if they evolved here, then the universe is so big, they must be in other places. Now, that is an assumption, obviously. There's no proof for this. It's a statistical assumption. But if that were true, they have to get here. That's the problem again. So if they're here, how did they get here? That presents the whole entire problem. You're going to have to start invoking spiritual categories, in which case now you've stepped outside a scientific worldview. So no, Steven Spielberg, I don't think that's going to be the case. Don't think so. Let's talk a little bit about Mormonism, and then we'll end with something I want to talk about regarding feminism. Okay, Mormonism. Let's start here. There was a tweet by Mike Lee. Mike Lee, senator from Utah. Can anyone tell me why the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints was left out of the list of Christian churches? Okay, well, this is Mike Lee saying Mormons are Christian, essentially. He's Mormon. How come you don't have Christian churches? Like, I want to be included. I'm Episcopal, Evangelical, Jehovah's. Even Jehovah's Witnesses were included, which is a little weird. But Mormonism is, I would argue Mormonism is further outside of Orthodoxy than Jehovah's Witnesses, because it's polytheistic, essentially. Now, this was one of the, there were so many reactions to this. This just, there's so much that could be talked about. But one of the ones that caught my eye was this guy, Harrison Smith. Now, Harrison Smith, I didn't know this until like yesterday, I happen to see a tweet. I got so many guys muted at this point that I just don't care that much to see what they're doing anymore. Especially on the, what would I even describe it as? It's in development, but this more ecumenical kind of Christian right based Christian right stuff. I think that this is my honest sense. I'm just going to like be straight up with you guys. I think that there's a Christian identity adjacent movement. Maybe it even is Christian identitarianism. And I've known about this for years. I haven't written about it or really researched it deeply just because it's not something that I thought was like a big, it's more of a fringe thing. I'm considering now doing something more about it, but be that as it may, there's kind of like it dovetails with the white European identitarian stuff that Christianity is the religion of those people. Okay. And that this occupies a socio-political identity being a Christian. Now there's some truth in the sense that are coming out of my mouth, you can sense there's a little bit of truth in the sense that, of course, being a Christian should determine in some ways how you vote, how you think about social issues, because the Bible has moral categories that it operates by, and it gives you a created order, at least tells you about it. Now, that's not quite the same thing, though. There are people in the Christian identity movement who look at white European civilizations, and they say that they are Christian in contrast to things like Judaism and in Islam, which is now invading Europe and so forth. And they don't attach necessarily the confessional elements of Christianity. For them, it is more of a purely cultural thing. You can be a Christian in a Christian identity conception and not be a born again believer. You don't even have to necessarily be a member of a church or someone who is pious or faithful in your life. You just need to be someone who is white, or at least has an ancestry that is European, and has something, maybe on a survey says you're a Christian, or you identify that way, but you can be totally, we'll just say, out of step with Christianity in your moral life, in your speech, in many of the things that you participate in, even in your beliefs, and still claim the Christian mantle. Now, you can see very easily how under this kind of thinking that prioritizes the culture so much and sees it as a purely cultural symbol, and the symbols of Christianity and the slogans of Christianity having so much power, including Christ as King, you can see if that becomes the main thing, these slogans and symbols and so forth, in a socio-political way, how this would ecumenicize, is that a word? I guess it is now, the people who participate in it, because that's a pretty low bar. So even, forget about denominational differences within Protestantism, your identity, if that's your main thing, is not going to look that different than a Roman Catholic or an Eastern Orthodox or even a secularist who says they're a Christian and has somewhat of a Christian identity on some things. So that's really the threat that I see. It on a spiritual level, it is a move towards a consolidation of these disparate factions into, we're going to try to hold on to our civilization, but we're going to start eroding ecclesiastical and doctrinal barriers in the name of doing that. I think this is my thing. I think you can actually form a civilizational wall while maintaining your doctrinal distinctions. That's been my contention since I can remember. Don't side with the Mormons on their, don't give them a pass on religion, even if they agree with you on anti-abortion and anti, you know, loose immigration laws and those kinds of things. This is why I'm very critical of, there was an event, I've said this a few times on the podcast a few years ago, to rededicate America to God. And Glenn Beck was a speaker. And I said, look, you got a Mormon there. None of those guys who came in 1607 were Mormon, or 1620 or after that. He's not a settler. This is not even, it's historically kind of inept. But even if we want to say, okay, Mormonism, though, is an American religion. It's truly American religion because it's an offshoot of the Burnover District revivalistic movements. It really is just like a Puritan, it's a puritanical kind of heresy is what it is. It's a Yankee Northeastern heresy that had to go out west. That's what Mormonism is in my mind. And it's got that same perfectionistic kind of sense. They're Yankees. Like in my, they are North. There's so many similarities. If you go to like Massachusetts, go to like a rural place in Massachusetts and then go to Utah. And there's a cultural similarity, or upstate New York, if you want to go there, where Joseph Smith was from. But anyways, I digress. You can't dedicate America with a Mormon and say that, oh, we're spiritually compatible. We're praying. You're not even praying to the same God. The God of Mormonism came from Kolob and had to populate this world with spirit babies. And you, if you follow the path of Joseph Smith, then you can also be a God, because Elohim was just like you. It's so messed up in so many ways. I read the Book of Mormon. I read the Doctrine and Covenants. I read the Pearl of Great Price. In fact, I think my version, I have all this stuff in the back of it to show where the Book of Mormon contradicts the Bible, even things down to like, why are people speaking in tongues before Pentecost? You know, it's like, there's so many errors. They use the King James English, so it sounds like it's, you know, authentic these and thous, but it's not. Mormonism is a polytheistic religion. It's works-based. They believe that you can be saved after all that you can do. It's very syncretistic. It is not, it doesn't resemble Christianity, except for the fact that they hat tip to the Bible. Of course, it's subordinate to the Book of Mormon. They believe in someone named Jesus. It's not the Jesus of Scripture. Some of the characters are the same. You know, they have that order of Melchizedek priesthood, but it's not the order Jesus is in. It's not it's not what you see in Scripture. It's you go to a Mormon church, you'll see it. It's like the little I don't know what they call them, altar boys, are in the order of Melchizedek. It's so different on so many levels. Their offices are different. It's just a completely different religion. But there are some similarities, and because they're obviously taking from the Bible, they're taking from Masonic rituals. There's a bunch of stuff kind of being forged into this religion. So I've been critical of that stuff, and I just see that stuff increasing on the political right. It seems like there's more of a willingness to cooperate with people of different theological persuasions. And I'm okay doing it politically for like, hey, we're going to do an event on abortion or something and stopping it. But there's the waters are merging, and there's a hat tip given to religions where there shouldn't be, as treating them like they're Christians. And so here's Harrison Smith. And I didn't know this until yesterday, but Harrison Smith, I guess he has a show now on the New Christian Right, which is, I guess, Joel Webbin's platform, which is interesting because he was on, I think, InfoWars. I think he still is, but he's got a show that he's speaking at the Christ is King conference. I've already pointed out how he blasphemes and just not the kind of person that exemplifies a Christian character in his online behavior. But I thought this was interesting. I don't know a lot about him, but I know enough to say, look, this is wrong. He says Mormonism is one of the single most interesting phenomena in the history of the world. It's clearly a giant scam started by a con man, deeply heretical and plagued with horrible corruption. Okay, I wish he stopped there, but it's undeniably magnificent. They figured something out. The results speak for themselves. Okay, what are the results? What do they figure out? What's so magnificent? I honestly do not know what to make of it. Well, you should, other than it has transmuted the American spirit and manifest destiny into a cult. It's like it's almost doesn't matter what the religion is exactly, as long as white people have a spiritual purpose. Oh, listen to this again. As long as white people have a spiritual purpose to centralize and motivate them, they will achieve greatness. Now, do you really think Mormonism has achieved greatness? Mormons have done, I guess, amazing things from the standpoint that they've settled out west and they built cities like the other people around them who aren't Mormon who did the same thing. But they definitely have their closed sort of their group. There's towns where everyone's a Mormon. And look, I've been friendly with Mormons. I've talked to Mormon missionaries. I don't have any problem interacting with Mormons on a social level. But their religion, their religious beliefs are the big threat. And that should be the thing to look at more than anything else. I know there are other things, though. Obviously, the suicide rate is fairly high in the Mormon community. I didn't look up anything before doing the podcast. I know years ago I looked up some of the testimonies of ex-Mormons who talk about a lot of sexual indiscretion and things happening behind closed doors that are covered up, pornography being a big problem in the Mormon community, that they're just about outward appearances. And if you're about outward appearances without the Holy Spirit, you may look good. I think even Ben Shapiro said something about how the Mormons get the closest to acting like Christ or something. And it's like, you know, I think if you look underneath the hood, I don't think that's true, but they have this reputation of being squeaky clean. And that is the reputation. That's what they want to project out there. Look at their commercials. It's all about families. You just join a big old family when you become a Mormon. But the big threat, I don't like, put all that stuff on the side. What if it truly was this great spiritual motivator? Well, it's false. It'll send you to hell. So it motivates you to try to work your righteousness so you go to hell? Like, how is that? It's magnificent. It's just great thing, because like, this is the kind of thing I'm seeing more and more of out there, that, well, you know, Eastern Orthodoxy, I may not agree with it, but hey, like, you can't argue with the fact that those guys are white. Like, this is a European religion, man. They know what's up with the Jews or something. It's like, what? I just looked up some stats in Russia the other day. I was reading this article, and it was saying like Eastern Orthodoxy is waning there like crazy. Islam is the fastest growing religion in Russia right now, despite the fact that they project like how great they're building all these churches. The government's building them to try to reinvigorate. And the population that goes to church, it's so low, guys. Russia's got massive problems. And that's not the image, though, they want to project to America, especially American conservatives. So this is the kind of thing, if you on a cultural level or a racial level of some kind want to make that the main thing and say, well, hey, it's good for white people, it's good for Europeans, or make out like the measure you should be looking when evaluating religion as to whether or not it's white, then you're going to get it wrong. You can go to many areas, even in our own country, even the United States, that are very monolithic in their culture, that are Southern Baptist, that are primarily Protestant towns. You know, go to rural Arkansas or Missouri or somewhere, and you can see places that are just like this, as far as, you know, moral behavior, for the most part, clean cut families. And it's not because of Mormons, right? It's because the culture there has inherited we can say the afterglow of Christianity, or maybe they're still practicing it in some ways. And you could say something similar about Mormonism. There's sort of an afterglow of cultural inheritance that they have, that, in other words, there's been habits that have been handed down by fathers to sons and sons to their sons. And some of that is a blessing. If you practice the principles of Proverbs, you don't have to be a Christian to receive just a common sense kind of blessing, because it makes sense. It's like the manual goes with the product. The Bible goes with the world. But you'll go to hell at the end of the day. So what does it matter if you win the whole world and lose your soul? That's kind of the issue that I have with this normalization of Mormonism as if it's Christian. So I just said, look, I thought Christ is King, because Harrison Smith, he's speaking at the Christ is King conference. Like, he knows something about Christ being King, and he's here to tell everyone about it. But it seems like white is King. And yeah, I got some blowback for this. Guess what? The best thing for your kinsmen, according to the flesh, is Christ, the real one, not lies that deceive people into false religion. I'm totally fine, guys, with, let's pursue really good cultural outcomes that dovetail with what we believe the Bible to be teaching, that are consistent with our history and heritage, that are preserving something, and let's join forces with co-belligerents. Keep those walls up, though. Don't give the impression that, oh yeah, this guy knows about Christ as King. Those Mormons, man, they know about what spiritual motivation's really like. And it's magnificent, that religion. Man, there's about 100 examples of that I could talk about. I chose to talk about this one because I happened to see it, and because I already weighed in on it. But that's the kind of thing I'm going to be talking about a little bit this weekend too, is like, how do we maintain these lines? If we start crossing these lines, then we're missing out. And it really is Marx's world, if you think about it. We're missing out on the spiritual dimension. It's the materialist stuff that we're looking at now all the time. And we're measuring the spiritual world by what the material world, what it does for us, what it does for our socio-political agenda of some kind. And we got to be careful of that. Spiritual things need to be kept in their place. Truth needs to be kept in its place. So, I see my wife and my daughter got home. I got to go play with them. I play with my daughter. She wants her daddy. So, all right, this podcast just got cut shorter. One last comment here. I wanted to talk about this briefly. I'm not going to play the clip. There's a clip though, from Ligonier Ministries here's the caption. Singleness can be a gift that the Lord uses for your good and his glory. Watch as Rebecca Van Dude Ward, I think is her name, encourages single women to be fruitful with the time God has given them. And all God's people said with a last name like that, aren't you Dutch Reformed? Not Presbyterian, but I guess she's Presbyterian. So this was an interview. I think it was her and her husband in the clip. You just see her, but he's giving advice as an older sage woman to single women. She says basically, look, marriage can be an idol if you're just sitting around waiting for a husband and not being productive in the things God has for you. I'm here to say, number one, that can be true. Number two, we've been inundated from Big Eva for years with this idea that marriage and family can be idolatry and to platform and emphasize singleness. So probably not the best choice of words given the circumstances, but it doesn't take away from the truth that she's saying. It is true that people can make a lot of things idols. It's really making yourself the idol. That's what it is. But you become complacent and you don't think of others. You stop fulfilling the commands of God because you're so hyper-fixated on this one thing that you think needs to fulfill you. And it could be a plethora of things. That is true. And there are single women I have seen do this, and men, but I've seen women wait around and not get involved in things that they could be getting involved with. The examples she gives are, she knows women who have been ministry, in careers, and serving and being impressive in these areas while they're still waiting for and hoping for God to provide a husband. And I think her point is actually true. Now, the other thing that got people's attention was the career thing, saying the word career and that women can have them. There were some very nasty comments from people, frankly, that should know better, people who are pastors and so forth, and just the worst kind of read on what this lady is saying. I think a responsible way to navigate this is to say, look, if what you're saying is women should, if they're not getting married, start ladder climbing and pursuing corporate, you know, being a boss babe, that's the word they use online, but being taking authority in a corporate setting of some kind as a replacement for marriage and family, then, you know, that could lead girls down a wrong path. I don't think that's what she was doing. And there's just such a sensitivity that people have to this. It's partially understandable. There's been years of feminism, but what she's saying in the main, her main point isn't wrong. And the Proverbs 31 woman is even an example of that. She is married and she's engaging in business. She's impressive. You can get an education. That was the other thing. You know, women don't need college educations. That's feminism, apparently. Look, you have to look at the circumstances we're in now and apply the timeless principles from the past. The circumstances we're in now, a bachelor's degree is basically what a high school diploma was in 1975. It just is. So, you know, hopefully if you have the resources and you're able to, I don't think there's anything wrong with a woman going to college. And it's going to be different for everyone with the circumstances. It doesn't mean you're a boss babe immediately. It just means that you're getting an education that will hopefully allow you to feed yourself if a husband doesn't come along, or if he does, you have a fallback. I mean, these are all responsible things. We live in a different kind of economy than we used to. So a lot of the skill sets that are able to help you survive in the economy we have are going to be things that are, it's not homesteading, we'll say. It may end up being even up to being a lawyer. I don't suggest that as normative, but there's couples I know where husband, wife, lawyer teams met in law school or whatever. And now she's helping them out. She's a helpmate, but she's got this knowledge. She's got this skill and it worked out. So there's nothing wrong with that kind of thing. There's nothing wrong with a female pursuing journalism. There's a lot of different careers females can pursue, but you certainly don't want to say, look, you need to focus on that to the detriment of pursuing marriage and family or get into debt. You don't want that. try to avoid that, right? You be a help to a future family that you're going to have, not a hindrance. I would say to a man too, be careful of debt. So this is the more, I think, holistic, responsible advice that we need. And I'm seeing a lot of tribes form over these things. Now, there was a R.C. Sproul quote I thought that was really good on this. One excruciating problem faced by single women is caused by the unwritten rule in our society that allows men the freedom to actively pursue a marriage partner, while women are considered loose if they actively pursue a prospective husband. No biblical rule says a woman eager to be married should be passive. So he goes on to say that, look, you should, if a woman wants to be married, she should pursue it. Go to places where you're going to meet single guys that are marriageable. Go to where single people congregate. Be involved in activities with single people. Be in close communication with single Christians. You can do that kind of thing. There's no rule against that. I thought that was helpful. Now he's talking about this rule in our society. I wonder if that's more Christian, you know, because I'm like, society wide, I don't think that's true, but maybe in his more conservative backgrounds, that's true. So I'm willing to take any questions, cries of outrage, or conundrums on this particular issue, and then we're going to end the podcast. But I felt the need to say that, and also to say that there's, I thought, a fairly helpful pamphlet that Benjamin Rush, who is one of the signers of, I think, was he both the Constitution and the Declaration? At least I think the Declaration. He founded the Young Ladies Academy, which was full first all-female academy, and he published a book called Thoughts Upon Female Education. I would encourage you to go read it. Check it out. This is in our Christian American past. Some of the points he makes, I think, are fairly interesting. Like, he talks about how women in America it's different than in England, where they have more time to study. In America, it's sort of like they're getting married young, it's frontier life. But he says, look, you need to know the English language, read, speak, spell. You need to know writing. You need to know penmanship. You need to know arithmetic, bookkeeping, geography. You need to know how to study history. You need vocal music, dancing, history, travel, poetry, moral essays. You need to know religion, theology. He believed that. He wanted to de-emphasize the reading of novels. He thought that it promoted unrealistic passions and blunted real sympathy. He wanted, and there's a variety of reasons for this. He thought it would make them better companions for husbands. That's true. I can say that with my own wife. It's good. She did Bible school for 2 years. And because of that, I think we have a better relationship in a way that we're just able to communicate about things. She has somewhat of an education. I know if she didn't have that, I've told her before, I don't even know if we would be married. I'm not sure. That was one of the things that we were able to have a commonality and kind of hit it off over, to raise up children, even sons, to train them, because women, if you're there training your children as a husband, you want them to know some things, to have a fallback, to have some skills to be able to use. I was reading, who was it? One of the great Presbyterian divines, not Warfield. I think it was Hodge. I think it was, Charles Hodge. His mother ended up she sold the home and bought a home near Princeton that she rented out to boarders. And that's how she paid for her son's education. So she had some business acumen that she could use. And that was really good. And you wouldn't have a Charles Hodge without it. And he basically says that we owe it all to our mom. So those are some reasons that it is good for women to be educated. That doesn't mean that it's normative for them to pursue these, the top of higher education and all that kind of thing. It's going to be based on circumstance. But the main thing is God wired females to be caregivers. They have a maternal sense, to be helpmates, it's normal for them to get married and have children. And that is the primary pursuit, and it should be for most females. You could say singleness is a gift while you have it. You have freedom to do certain things. Marriage is, I would say, even a greater gift in a way. I mean, God said it wasn't good for man to be alone, and he gave him a helper suitable to him. So this is biblical stuff 101. But in the context in which we are in now, where an undergrad is basically a high school diploma, where we live in a market economy, we're having a skill. Unless you have a big homestead and know how to run a farm, you're probably going to need some kind of a different skill to be able to survive if your husband dies or something like that. I say not a bad thing to get a skill. It doesn't have to be college, but it might be. And there's Christian freedom in this. And I think the thing that made me want to say something about this is there are way too many comments that I saw, even from people who are spiritual leaders, that just seemed to indicate that they thought it was sinful for a woman to have a career or something. And I have said this like three times. I feel like I have to emphasize it. If you place that above marriage and family, then yes. If you say that the career is going to be the fulfilling thing, that's a lie. It's not, you're not going to be fulfilled like you think in a career. Feminism does lie. But we're not going to bind people's consciences and say, well, it's wrong to have a career or something like that. There are women who are very capable in many different fields. And it doesn't necessarily take away from the future family they may have, or in some cases, the family they do have. If they can add to the home economy, which I think is the important thing to evaluate. Are they submitting to their husband? Are they adding to the home economy? Okay. Well, now that I'm going to be called a feminist by some guys who are just, I don't know if they're really burned or what it is, but I will accept the arrows. There's a lot of comments. I'm looking for questions though, guys. Any questions about SBC, anything? A lot of comments about Willie Rice. Some anti-Mormon polemic, Stormy Squad says, might be needed. They have cute girls promoting it in advertisements. Yeah, I've noticed that too. I saw that once. I didn't know if that was common, but I got a weird ad where I was on a video or something. And I'm like, what is this? What is up with Joel Webbin? Lots. Lots is... I think there was an opening in sort of that vein that I was talking about before, that more, I don't know even what to call it quite, the Christian sort of identitarian adjacent group, that I think there was an opening for someone who's a Protestant pastor. And look, because of institutional mechanisms of accountability and so forth, it's going to be hard to get guys who have spiritual status as a leader to institutional status to be in those circles, just because as soon as they start talking about things that are very edgy, then they'll have problems. But I think if you're an independent guy like Joel is, and you have your church, and then there's really not oversight or accountability or anything like that from the outside or with, in a network of churches or anything like that, that sort of gives you an advantage in being able to fill that role, because a lot of the edgy stuff and transgressive stuff that's becoming more popular in online circles, it has to at this stage be outside of those institutions. So I think there was an opening, and I think he's in it. Like that's kind of maybe a simple way to look at it. Okay, let's see. More questions. Hi, John. Wondering all the time about women being silent in church. In the sense of practicing spiritual oversight, preaching, and those kinds of things, yes, they should be silent in church. This is something that Christians get called, names for, and they're sexist or misogynistic, but this is just what the Bible teaches, that women are to be silent. They're not supposed to be disrupting services, and they're not supposed to be exercising authority over men in the sense of preaching in a gathered assembly. That's not their role. So there are questions about, okay, well, where are the lines on this as far as can they read scripture? Can they recite can they sing on stage, for example? Can they contribute to that? Can they share a prayer request and I think the answer to that, there are different traditions that sort of look at these things a little differently, but I think the answer is they can, I'm going to be careful of choosing my words wisely here. Women are permitted to obviously say words in the context of church. I mean, even to just give instructions to children and so forth, they have to do that, right? I mean, it's kind of inescapable. I don't think it's a blank check of the, you never say a word everywhere. I think that the context is specifically using the prophetic gift. So women are not to be exercising the office of the prophet in church. I mean, that's really the context of 1 Corinthians 14. That's how I see it. I'm open to other interpretations of that, but the last time I checked that out, I think that's MacArthur's position as well. That seemed to make the most sense to me. And it dovetails with the other passages we have on the topic, which say not to teach, not to exercise authority over a man. Now in the Corinthian church, you had a lot of messed up stuff too. You also had services being disrupted, people causing chaos. And that's why, hey, decency and order, guys. And look, don't just sort of like disrupt the service and start blurting things out, which is, I think, why Paul says, go ask your husband at home. But I'd have to brush up on the passage. It's been a while since I've studied that passage in minute detail, but that's what I remember from the last time I looked at it. Ella says, I'm a worship leader and lead singer, and my husband is the band director. What's your biblical opinion about this? I don't know in your church what that means, lead singer. If that just means you're the one that carries the melody, you're singing the soprano line, then I don't see anything wrong with that. Your husband, now I'll tell you what we do at my church, because we do have women come up and sing and even play instruments. I just had a flute player and a piano player who are both female last Sunday, and I'm the lead singer in the sense that I'm singing the melody. But if a female is there and she's singing the melody, she is not to be giving instructions about sitting down, standing up, and all that kind of thing. That's something that a male does. So we have people who run the service, even if it's another instrumentalist at times, we've had another male give instructions like, you may now be seated, so as to avoid spiritual instruction. And some people might think that that is overkill, but it's really just to stay away from that ledge as much as possible. But yeah, women serve in the capacity of helping the congregation sing. And sometimes there's songs that have female parts and male parts. It's helpful to have a male or a male up there. God doesn't say women can't prophesy. Singing hymns in church is prophecy. Women cannot have authority. That's a good question. Is singing the act of prophecy? Is it foretelling the word of God? It is certainly, there is a teaching element to it because you are saying true things. I'd have to chew on that, to be quite honest with you a little bit, as to whether or not I think singing is a little bit different in this sense. You are reciting words that someone else has come up with, and you are enhancing the congregation's ability to worship. It's a corporate thing that everyone's participating in a congregational singing context. So if you're really going to take that to its conclusion, then women who are sitting in the congregation shouldn't be singing either, right? It's not really a matter of whether you're on the location, whether you're standing on stage or not. So I can see why someone, if they think that's prophecy, they have to say that women can prophesy now. The gift of prophecy has, as you know, multiple elements though to it, multiple ways it's practiced. You have the forthtelling element, you have a foretelling element. And I think there are unique circumstances in which you have prophetesses in the Old Testament, even in the New Testament, like Anna doing that kind of thing, but it's not normative. And the prophetic word, what we think about as far as what the preacher does, okay, what the pastor does, is what the SBC is arguing right now, that he has a special, unique role when he delivers a sermon, when he declares the word of God. There is a special level of authority there that is not present when you're reciting the written words of a song that everyone's singing. So if you want to divvy that up and say they're both prophecy, one is prophecy of a different authoritative nature. I'm comfortable saying the prophecy that Paul is talking about in 1 Corinthians 14 is not the same as music and singing. I don't see it that way, at least. I think it is an instruction that God is giving to the church. And I'm spending way too much time on this. I got to go play with my daughter, guys. All right, one more. No, John, you are supposed to take my comment the other way. Of course, women have the gift of prophecy. Prophecy is confused with teaching and preaching often. Okay. All right. Well, maybe I'm confusing it then. Maybe we have a different way we cut the cake here. And maybe, I mean, I have an ordination next week, so maybe I got to figure this out and get it straight before then. I went through this years ago, but it's been a long time, and I'm sort of falling back on what I remember from that. Teaching is didactic instruction, not conversational. Okay. All right. Well, I can buy that. I mean, here's another question, you know, is the list in 1 Corinthians 12 comprehensive? And I don't think it is. I actually think there's spiritual gifts that go beyond that list. I think that the office of the offices are like that are given apostle, prophet, prophet, the pastor, shepherd role, even the office of the evangelist, even. I think these are specific roles God has ordained in a church context. But I think that, you know, things like gift of helps, I mean, it's very broad. And I think that there could be things that aren't, maybe you could jam them in one of those, but they're not specifically outlined, right? And music even falls into that, perhaps, that, you know, I have a gift, I can really play this particular instrument. Okay, well, good. You know, and all of the really traditional presbys said, why are you using instruments? But I think you can use instruments. Or I really have a knack. Look, I've known guys that are like, man, I don't know what my spiritual gift is, but I can really fix a car. All right, deacon, you're going to go, you know, you're going to work on the church vehicles. You're going to use those skills, those technical abilities for a deacon adjacent role. And I think that's, they're just spiritual gift. The whole thing is that it is a edification upon the church. It builds up the church. So, all right, maybe we'll do something more on this when I can more clearly think through all of it. I just wanted to make the broad point that look, girls, like, look, ladies, you can go out there and meet people. Don't be afraid of that. I know it's scary. Don't just sit around. And it's okay to pursue excellence in whatever work God has called you to, so long as you are prioritizing the design that he made for you, which is to have a husband and have children. That's going to be normative for most women, okay? And if that doesn't happen, it's totally fine for you to pursue other things, but you must be in submission. You must be under the submission of the spiritual authorities in your life. And if, you know, another thing that I know some people were saying is like, well, you know, what about the submission to her father? Well, if you're blessed with that, sure. I know so many situations though, where the father's just doesn't take that seriously at all. Doesn't protect, doesn't understand his responsibilities, isn't even a Christian. That's becoming the norm. So if you have that, you're blessed. If not, then I would just encourage you, find someone at your church, maybe your pastor, that can have some kind of a spiritual authority over you. And then pray. Pray that the Lord brings someone along. I know there's many of you who are praying and you've done your best, and it's discouraging. You feel like you're between a rock and a hard place. And I will say to the men as well, because I've said that many times, that look, I know some of you are in a similar position and you're trying to make yourself attractive and available, and you're doing everything right and you don't know why it's gone wrong, and you're looking for hope. And so many of you are doing such a good job in this area, and I don't know the reason why, but I know God's in control, and I know he brings trials in to strengthen us. And it's hard to see those trials sometimes as gifts, but they can be opportunities. So try to see them that way as much as you can, while admitting it's a trial, and carry on. And I pray the Lord brings you spiritual blessings through that season. All right. Well, God bless. I hope this was helpful for all of you, and pray for the Southern Baptist Convention tomorrow. Bye now.